Second Peter chapter 2, and I'll begin reading at verse 9, just to finish off where we left off. The Lord knoweth how to deliver the godly out of temptations, and to reserve the unjust at the day of judgment to be punished. But chiefly them that walk after the flesh and the lust of uncleanness, and despise government. Presumptuous are they, self-willed, they are not afraid to speak evil of dignities. Whereas angels which are greater in power and might bring not railing accusations against them before the Lord. But these as natural brute beasts, made to be taken and destroyed, speak evil of the things that they understand not, and shall utterly perish in their own corruption, and shall receive the reward of unrighteousness, as they that count it pleasure to riot in the daytime. Spots are they, and blemishes, spoil themselves with their own deceivings, while they feast with you, having eyes full of adultery, and that cannot cease from sin, beguiling unstable souls, and heart they have exercised with covetous practices, cursed children, which have forsaken the right way, and are gone astray, following the way of Balaam, the son of Bozor, who loved the wages of unrighteousness, but was rebuked for his iniquity. The dumb ass speaking with man's voice forbade the madness of the prophet. These are wells without water, clouds that are carried with a tempest, to whom the mist of darkness is reserved forever. When they speak great swelling words of vanity, they allure through the lust of the flesh, through much wantonness, those who are clean escaped from them who live in error. While they promise them liberty, they themselves are the servants of corruption. For whom a man is overcome, of the same as he brought in bondage. If after they have escaped the pollutions of the world, through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled therein, and overcome, the latter end is worse with them than the beginning. For it had been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness, than after they had known it, to turn from the holy commandment delivered unto them. But it has happened unto them according to the true proverb, the dog is turned to his own vomit again, and the sow who is washed to a wallowing in the mire. Now, originally, our brother was going to take up the first 11 verses, and then I was going to take the remaining of the first 10 verses, I was going to take from verse 11 to 22. But really, the division really comes in the middle of verse 10. But I did want to say a little bit about the last part of verse 9, and to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished, or, reading the English Revised Version of 1885, and to keep the unrighteous under punishment unto the day of judgment. Now, if we were to follow, we want to try to avoid technicalities as much as we can, but if we were to follow the Greek exactly, it seems that they're under punishment now, awaiting a future judgment. But now, how can this be? Well, one possibility is we know that all unsaved ones, all responsible unsaved ones that abide are already in Hades, in torment, awaiting the great white throne judgment. Now, we know that's a possibility, but since it's in the same verse, with the righteous being delivered out of temptation in this life, I think it's rather to be preferred that, as W. E. Vine says, this is a futuritive present. Or, as Calvin takes it, that they're really now reserved for a future a judgment and punishment, rather than being punished right now. But now we'll go on, the things that could be said, and I want to leave time for some of us to say something on that verse or walk any further. I'll just say this, that verse 10b, the first part of verse 10 is explaining the judgment that our brother has been dealing with in the earlier part of this afternoon. And then beginning at presumptuous, he again resumes characteristics of these false teachers. Now, somebody might want to make a division for the last six verses, verses 17 to 22. We could say the emptiness of the false teachers or the doom of the false teachers. But anyway, we'll leave the meeting open, and I hope the brethren will be free to help as they have done already.
I should say this, that we are getting reports that what we're saying is just sort of among ourselves. We want to say it for the benefit of all that are gathered here and speak up and so that all can hear what is being said.
Would it help if that mic right there was lowered a little bit more toward the level of both of your mouths? Yeah.
Ad living between yourself.
Ad living? They want to get out on the jokes.
If anything, anyone has something to say on the last part of verse 9 before I say anything on the first part of verse 10, I'd like them to be free to do so.
I would like a clarification of your statement on that. I didn't quite follow you.
Okay, well, I'll repeat it. See, the English Revised comes closer to the Greek under punishment, and to follow that exactly, it sounds like they're under punishment right now while they're living. Although, a possible way of taking it is that it's referring to the unrighteous ones who have died, and we know for sure that they are in torment right now in Hades, awaiting the judgment of the great white throne. But while in verse 9, it's in the same verse with the living being delivered out of temptation, I think it's to be preferred to take it like W.E. Vine says it's a futuritive present, or as Calvin takes it as anticipatory, that they're just kept now for judgment that's to be, and punishment that's to be in the future.
In other words, it's like Jude ordained for this condemnation. That's the thought. And speaking of these men, turn the grace of God into men of this character are ordained for this condemnation, a judgment in accordance with their character.
You could link it up with that. Is that right?
What would you link it with? The wrath of God abideth on them?
Yes, you could do that with that one. John 3, verse 36.
But that's upon everyone. So there's a special judgment reserved.
Right. See, because verse 10 goes into that. But chiefly.
Yeah.
The same thing, right.
But chiefly. See, all unsaved ones will be punished, but especially, that's a force of this word translated chiefly, especially these false teachers who go headlong into immorality.
I'm going to ask this about
this. Sure.
If this is an apostate, it's not only the thought of the wrath of God upon him, it's the thought he's ordained, not as an individual, because of it, he's in a state of apostasy, and I would link it to Hebrews 6, he's ordained for this condemnation, that's why I mentioned that. In other words, this character, this type of character, has one destiny, and that's condemnation, because he's an apostate that denies the Lord, the thought, and is in that place. Now I'm going to ask.
Yes, I thought that the word reserve carried that connotation. That the Lord, as it were, puts a label upon him, and there's no question of this person evading the judgment. He knows how to reserve the unjust unto the day of judgment to be punished. And I personally here would prefer the authorized version because it seems to be in keeping with the general friend of the apostles' view on the day of judgment, which comes out again in chapter 3.
Then in verse 10, but sheep and them that walk after the flesh and the lust of uncleanness and despise government. All infidels will be punished, but especially these who walk after the flesh, and the flesh would be the totally depraved nature.
You find that in keeping with the times of 1981 there.
Right. The lust of uncleanness or defilement. It's interesting that 2 Peter has something like 20 words that's only used here. And especially more than half of them in the last part of the chapter. And this is one of them. And then there's a similar word later on in verse 20. But one is really the process. This one is the process, and the other one is the thing that defiles.
Could you give us a little further help on that expression, despise government? Well, I think we understand it, but it should be amplified because of what we see in our newspapers and so on. And uprisings here and there. That's how I'm looking in my mind, but is it what is in your mind?
Right, okay. Really, despise government. Presumptuous is really daring, self-willed. They're not afraid to speak evil of dignities. Now, this is really a progression. Speaking evil of dignities is a further development of evil. It begins with despising government. And then daring. And then self-willed. All leading to speaking evil of dignities.
Well, one thing that I have a difficulty with in both in Jude and in 2 Peter, in a Bible reading like this, is to communicate who we're talking about. These apostates that we're talking about here and that are in Jude, in some sense form a class all by themselves. And we find features of those type of men in our world today. But they're a unique sort of men, in a way. Am I not right? In other words, I can find features. You take liberal theologians today, okay? That is men in our so-called Christian churches who are denying fundamental truth and who are opening the door to a different standard of morality. They have some of the features of these apostates. And cult leaders, like we were talking about before, they have some of the features of these apostates that are here too. But there are certain specific things, like this speaking evil of dignities seems to be an expression that's uniquely true of these men. The particular error that they had turned to is described by that. Now, am I coming across right?
Yes, I think though that there is something very general in verse 10 as well, but chiefly them that walk after the flesh, that is the course of life which they choose, is because it is for their good, that is what they think is their good, in the lust of defilement. And this is immorality at its very worst. Is this not the fruit of evil teaching and unrestrained living? And then it comes to despising government, that any restraint that government may put upon these things is despised. Unfortunately, most of our governments these days are not restraining the immoralities of the day, but they're actually utilizing them. But the point is here that it's in order to pursue the path of their life, they despise any governmental restrictions.
You use the word good there. Isn't the word, the thought really for their enjoyment? It's what they're going into and striving. Not for the good so much. Because it isn't for the good, it's what they want to do.
What they think.
The liberality is what we...
Exactly.
If it is enjoyable, it is right.
That's the
maxim they're operating under. That could be expressed in modern day language.
Yes.
More openly.
Which really indicates that the standard is a standard that they set themselves to suit themselves.
The lust of uncleanness or the lust of defilement are very suitable words to describe both perverted sex and sex outside of marriage.
sex within marriage is beautiful, clean, pure, and wholesome for both saved and unsaved. Hebrews 13, verse 4, marriage is honorable in all and the bed undefiled, but adulterers and whoremongers God will judge. So, but perverted sex or sex outside of marriage is suitably described as lust of uncleanness or lust of defilement. And that's been bringing up to this day.
There was a comment there that you were going to make, Dave.
I wouldn't want to detract from the practical application made from the verse, but isn't that the trend of the thought of the verse, spiritual rather than political? For instance, government, is this political government? Or, in other words, man's government? Or is this moral government as principle of the Word of God? And the dignities here, is this dignitaries, that is, or is it as the word is, doxa, meaning glories, which would pertain to the person of Christ?
Well, let me take that a step further then while you're on that question. Is it possible that verse 10 is a flashback on the three instances we have looked at?
Especially the first part of it. It's very definite, the first part is very definitely connected with it. But I think, like I mentioned earlier, speaking evil of dignities, I believe, is a progression, taking in even part of the first part of the verse. So there's a transition.
We go back to denying the Lord, the thought, and the thought that we were working on there also. Divine ownership and sovereign control.
I think that the examples of the past, in other words, today we got a new morality. And Jude and Peter say it's nothing but the old immorality. That was it. He says, okay, I judged it in the past in Sodom and Gomorrah. Right? And any restraint by government, be it any government, okay, for the powers that be are ordained of God, and government, no matter who holds the office, government per se, is to be respected and obeyed. And so, he says, they have no respect. God forbid that anyone should be marching up and down in protest against the government in that sense of the word. And so that's what's taking place. And so that now there's churches on the West Coast that marry two men in plain English. That's to be blunt and clear. 10 years ago, we wouldn't say it, but we'll say it today. But God says, I'll judge it. I can judge it in the present, I judged it in the past, and I'll reserve it for a special judgment in the future. Now these, I was going to say boys, these apostates that teach this, God is now bringing out their character in full. And he starts to say, they really they only have one motivation, a lust of the flesh, period, nothing of God. He says they're like natural brute beasts, they're just like the animal out there. They should, that's the next verse there. They should be taken, captured, and killed. That's the thought. That's the way God describes this characteristic there. They're apostates, they despise government, and they're against all that glories or dignities, exalted positions, whether it be the position of an angel or anyone in government. But they're taking that exalted position and making nothing of it if it goes contrary to what they believe in practice. And so God says, now the way I judged it in the past, I will judge it also in the future. And then he takes the example of Michael, the archangel. And he says he stayed right in the position God put him, didn't he? And he didn't bring a railing accusation against Satan. But these fellows, they rail and bring accusation, things they know and don't know, just if it doesn't agree with them. I'm connecting you with this. So these men are moving in a realm all their own, motivated by the flesh and fleshly lust, for their own profit. Now that's just summarizing those three verses.
Dignities could be glories. It's most often translated that way. It could also be angels. But I myself think it's referring to delegated authority. We read of denying the Lord that bought them, and this could be speaking evil of dignities in the assembly that have delegated authority and could go further to delegated authority in the world.
It seems...
I'm rather inclined to that view, though.
Okay. I was going to say, it's the whole principle of dominion, of order. The angels, without our understanding what Peter is specifically referring to here, were not subject to their order, their place in God's order, and so on. Follow through. In every application, that comes in the home when you get the features in 2 Timothy chapter 3, the order is disregarded in the home, disobedient to parents, for example. That could very well be on the same principle that we're here working on.
See, the self-will, that's for our day too. Doing their own thing.
I think it's helpful, as Frank has been saying, for someone brought up in the present society, we can trace where the present movement has come from, okay? And we see how it's developed and the effect of the, you know, the 60s and all this kind of stuff. And that's a natural explanation for us. And we see it exists and we see the reason why it exists. But if we unmask it, as the scripture does, it is simply the same old thing with a new face put on. It's man expressing himself in his most base form.
In contrast to these false teachers, are so free with their insults, the angels so revere the law that all their lives they restrain what they say out of respect for the judge and his presence. And really, before the law, that really has a very practical lesson for us. Really, everything we say is really before the law. And we need to constantly remind ourselves that what we say is before the law. And you know, the more we have that in our minds, the more it tames what we say. And really, while this blasphemy, or speaking evil, is very often against those in leadership, Titus 3 verse 2 shows that it can apply to any man. Speak evil of no man. So it's not confined to leadership. We should be careful of how we speak of anybody as before the law. But then verse 12, but these as natural brute beasts, made to be taken and destroyed, speak evil of things that they understand not, and shall utterly perish in their own corruption. He's referring back to the false teachers in verse 10, and he'd just been speaking of the angels in verse 11, so he's contrasting, he's coming back showing the contrast. These false teachers are natural brute beasts, or creatures of instinct. They don't even think rationally.
I thought that was a good point to raise there, because it is their animal nature that takes over. They are irrational, and therefore are insensitive to principles.
Right.
They're not prepared to be governed by outlined principles.
Right. They're insensitive to everything but their own fleshly lusts, right. And they're determined to satisfy them at any cost.
At any cost. That's right.
Isn't it fearful to think that this kind of thing could have masqueraded in Christianity?
Doesn't that also still today?
I was wondering if somebody could give some help on this. While Peter seems to be speaking of false teachers that in the future, some of the things he says seem to be of them right there then. Like, for instance, the last part of verse 13, while they feast with you, would seem to indicate that they're living right then.
Well, I was going to say at the beginning of chapter 2 that while Peter uses the future, there shall be, Jude takes the present view that they're already here.
Right. And occasionally Peter himself uses the present tense.
I think that comes clear as the chapter conclusion.
Right. Do you take from that, Mr. Bentley, that the thought is that Peter is not saying that they're not here now, but he is speaking from a prophetic viewpoint?
Correct. And he would have a longer view, shall we say, in his prophetic tense.
Now, the last part of the verse, there's a play on the words that's missing from our English version. I'll quote the English Revised because I think they bring out the play on the words that's right there. Shall in their destroying surely be destroyed? See, they're not only found in it, but they're delighting in it, they're pursuing in it, and they're going to finally perish in the final issue of it.
Isn't the word ignorant very interesting? They are ignorant. Whereof they are ignorant, following the Revised, if we will, in verse 12, in contrast to the emphasis of knowledge, which the believer possesses so much in this epistle. That's a sharp contrast, isn't it?
Right. These false teachers probably thought, boasted in their knowledge, and Peter's not afraid to use the words to give it a different meaning to the hearers. They claim to know, and so that they were Gnostics. You know, agnostic is one who claims you can't know. Well, that's really from the Greek. But the agnostics all would prefer the Greek word instead of the Latin equivalent, which is ignoramus, ignorance.
So that their corruption will engulf them eventually in the ways of God. That is, the government of God will so act as to use their destruction as their own destruction. What they have been pursuing will be the very thing in which they will be themselves engulfed and warrant their eternal destruction.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Their pleasure becomes their destruction.
That's right.
And then verse 13, and shall receive the reward of unrighteousness. Peter seems to be speaking sarcastically here. The reward of unrighteousness. Look down to verse 15. Balaam, who loved the wages of unrighteousness. It's the same with this distinction. Balaam loved the wages of unrighteousness for this life. But in verse 13, he's speaking of eternal wages of unrighteousness.
That word received there in our Authorized is interesting too, Walter. Peter uses that word three times, twice in his first epistle and one time here. And in the first epistle, it's always good. Receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your soul. And when the chief shepherd shall appear, ye shall receive a crown of glory. In other words, the Lord has especially set aside for the believer something. Of course, now, receiving the end of your faith, even the salvation of your souls. And in that day, the faithful among those who are under shepherds, they're going to receive something specially tendered by the Lord. Here's something that the Lord has specially tendered for these men. Judgment.
Very good.
It must be emphasized, that last point, because the word suggests a passive. It is something that's going to be imposed upon them, whether they take hold of it or not. On the other side, we are taking hold of things. These people, whether they do it or not, they're going to be engulfed in divine judgment. Receiving unrighteousness as the reward of unrighteousness. Terrible judgment, really.
And the counted pleasure to riot in the daytime. We might think of Peter's words in Acts 2, verse 15, these are not drunken as you suppose, seeing it is the third hour of the day. And then 1 Thessalonians 5, verse 7, they that are drunken in the night. I wonder if anybody could give help. Well, looking up this word riot, I find out that the word isn't
as bad as I thought it would be. It's living delicately. Like the only other time it's used in connection with John the Baptist, the Lord said, they that live delicately are in King's courts.
I thought the idea was that they have so much money they don't need to work.
Oh, okay, that'd go along with it.
Luxurious.
Yeah, that's luxurious. Right, luxuriating.
And the emphasis is on the daytime, at the time when people should work, they're not working at all.
Very good.
And they're living effeminately, right, luxuriously.
It's a related word to sporting themselves down at the end of later on in the verse. And it's idyllic living. Is that right,
Luke?
Yeah, but I can mix some things up there. there is a sense of condemnation in what is being spoken here. No question.
All right. Spots are they and blemishes, sporting themselves with their own deceivings, while they feast with you.
As if showed the subtlety, and now Peter is unmasking the fact that they're intruding, finding acceptance amongst the truth, amongst the believers.
Right, with you.
With you.
Right.
What does he mean, spots there and blemishes?
Spot would be a moral spot and blemish. It's interesting that the negative of both of these are in one verse of Peter, 1 Peter 1, verse 19, about the precious blood of Christ without spot and without blemish. The negative of both of these.
The offering was to be without spot, without blemish. We get that from Peter. The sacrifice of Christ was without it. We were just hearing spot or blemish. The spot is something added to. The blemish is something from. A sin of commission or omission is a thought that's been, I just mentioned these, that have been brought out in the two. In the life of Christ, there was never a sin of omission. It was lived to the full. There was no spot in everything, anything committed, neither two. These here are spots and blemishes. They omit what God desires, and they commit what God doesn't desire. They're guilty of both sides of events, sins of commission and omission. That might be just in the way of an application, but
yeah.
It applies to the picture that it illustrates.
Isn't that the thought also, that looking upon the company of God's people, there they are, the most beautiful sight on earth among people. And gather together. And yet here are those among them that are living this way. And therefore they stand out like a bump on the log, or like a sore thumb, we use the expression. Therefore they spot their blemish.
Who
destroying the beauty of the testimony.
Who is it said he hath not beheld iniquity in Jacob?
Balaam.
Hmm? Yeah. Not Balaam? Right? I connect that in here. That these were actually not before God, as far as the elect are concerned, but by their presence among them, they were bringing defilement into the testimony.
I would have thought the spot meant disgrace, and the blemish meant defilement. The disgrace is the result of the defilement. So their very presence was a dishonor to the people of God in every way.
Seems to be even another danger, getting back to what David says. Jude says, and that's translated in Jude a little differently, it says spot in your feet, sunken rocks. It seems that they're also, they don't know a surface, and while this character is clear here, they don't know a surface this way, but it'll surely wreck the fellowship.
Yeah.
Now, these spots will wreck the fellowship of an assembly. Any character of this nature, anything of this kind, allow it to continue. Like that sunken rock, the boat will inevitably be wrecked if it continues on that course. And so Jude brings it out, there are sunken rocks in your peace, in your fellowship. So wreck the fellowship. They can't be tolerated there. These are the same two words as 1 Peter chapter 1.
Negative. The negative. The exact same word, but the negative are those.
I wanted to check that because I know in 1 Peter chapter 1 that the word spot is external and the word blemish is internal.
Oh.
The Lord was, the Lamb was to be pure within and without, so that was pure of the Lord. Well, if that's the case here, then there is the suggestion that what Brother Tony Condisi has just been saying, allow them inside and they will work internal damage. The damage, not only external, spots, but there will be damage internally as well. To
yes. That's why he called it disgrace.
Yes.
Outwardly. Defilement inwardly.
Right.
What about these feasts, Walter, while they feast with you? Is that while they break bread with you? The Lord's Supper? What's the time?
It's a good question. I think it's probably referring to the love feast that they did used to have. I take it before the breaking of bread.
Is a love feast the breaking of bread?
No, I took it as a separate feast, didn't you?
Yes, yes, but then it is a question if love feasts are in view. I think we're colored here by the direct reference in Jude.
Right.
The word deceivings and the word love feast have been pointed out by the authorities. The distinction is not very great. And therefore, it could be one or the other. But the idea, I thought, they feast with you, is in the middle voice, which means that they feast with their own end in view. And therefore, I thought it was a general feasting, a general intermingling. And they're amongst the saints with a very real ulterior motive in being there. And that motive is to gain as many followers as they possibly can in a pernicious way. For me, it's a general thought.
Not much
particular.
I'm much happier with that. I brought out the other just to make the distinction for the believer, because some of the literature will give you the idea that we have a love feast on Sunday morning, and that is not true. It is not called so in the Word of God. It is not what we are keeping. We are keeping the Lord's Supper.
That's right. Altogether.
But you're, as far as feasting here is a general thing.
And even in Jude, that's not referring to the breaking of bread as a love feast either.
No, that's why I want, the writers don't distinguish that, this, and some of them don't anyway.
Oh,
so I just wanted to distinguish that.
And then verse 14, having eyes full of adultery. Here's another instance of Peter emphasizing the sight and reminding us too of the Lord's words, Matthew 5, verse 28, whosoever looketh upon a woman to lust after her hath committed adultery already with her in his heart. And of course, any woman or girl who deliberately dresses to entice to lust is equally guilty.
Isn't that mentioned having eyes of adultery?
Right. Literally, the adulteress, that is, these men, they lust after every woman, they look at every woman as a potential adulteress with them in sin. Eyes full of adultery.
The reason I say that is to show the definite character of these men. These men have such an immoral character that nothing else fills their thoughts.
Mm. It fills their thoughts is a good way to express having eyes full. And that's what Peter is saying. Walter has emphasized his use of sight. Peter is saying what you have your eye on is what you become.
Mm.
As you look at the moral implications, as well as the doctrinal intonations in this chapter, you would think you're on the Sermon on the Mount. We've been on the Mount of Transfiguration, the previous chapter. You would think that the Apostle now is drawing some very practical conclusions, in the negative way, of course, from positive teaching of the Lord. This reference that our brother has given us just now, about the looking upon a woman for adultery, is really the Sermon on the Mount ministry, isn't it?
Mm, right.
Right?
Right.
And therefore, it lets us see how practical such a ministry should be in our lives today. And we should be very, very careful that we're not developing in our own souls such lusts even today. We should be very careful of that as the people of God. Very possible that we could be ensnared in this very way.
Right.
How we look upon women.
Right, and we can't really
We can't really cherish filthy literature or cherish filthy thoughts without it eventually affecting us. That's far more seriously.
I wanted you to touch on that because I think it's very, very practical today.
Not only filthy literature as far as visual things, Walter, but also much of the literature that is available, it wouldn't really be called filthy literature. Or what's on the TV, you know, these soap operas and all that kind of thing. Picture women as all being potential adulteresses and men as all being potential adulterers. And if the thinking of that kind of thing reaches the believer's heart, it is destructive.
Right. Proverbs 8 verse 13, the fear of the Lord is to hate evil. So if we really live in the fear of God, we'll hate these wrong thoughts. Doesn't mean that none of them will ever come, but we won't cherish any of them. We'll judge them. In 2 Corinthians 7 verse 1, having therefore these promises, dearly beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God. And there's nothing like the fear of God to regulate our thoughts. Because unless I blurt out my thoughts with my mouth, nobody knows what I'm thinking, but God does.
I think it's good to see that the apostle recognizes a distinction between the readers of his epistle and those assumed in verse number 14. He speaks of them here, beguiling unstable souls, or enticing unsteadfast souls.
Right.
That's the same word, isn't it, in the positive, that he uses at the end of the epistle, that you fall not from your own steadfastness. So I think that he looked upon his readers as being steadfast souls, not unsteadfast souls. He credited them with the being steadfast, right? Distinct from unsteadfast.
Right. His whole ministry was, strengthen thy brethren, that you may be established in the present truth. The God of all grace, establish, strengthen, settle you.
That's right.
It's the same word, related word to us.
That's right.
That word, beguiling or enticing, is the baiting of the hook, isn't it?
Right.
So they're baiting these simple souls by that type of life. And in verse 18, the same thing. They're baiting them with these great swelling words. So in both cases, they're baiting the hook. And the one that's doing the biting are these simple souls that feel, well, I can go along with this kind of life and still maintain my religion or whatever they're claiming. And so on.
Right, because that word is only used three times in the New Testament. You refer to twice of them, two of them. The other one's James 1, verse 14. To catch with bait. And it's interesting coming from Peter the fisherman using this fishing term, to catch with bait. The word that's translated beguiling is enticing.
The overall...
You're smiling, brother.
No, that was born out in his ministry last Saturday at the Byfield Conference.
No.
Fly fishing instead of worms on the hook.
Yeah.
Well, I was there Saturday.
Yeah. Well, I used the illustration.
Sunday.
Yes. The illustration was the bait on the hook, and the fish having in him what responds to the bait. And as he moves to it, of course, he's hooked. And that is the point in James which I referred to. Sin, when it is, lust, when it is conceived, bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death.
I heard you.
Yeah.
And so surely...
That's the language our brother's using now. Yeah?
Right. And so surely this shows us the depth of the sin of these false teachers. Not only do they indulge these things, but they try to get unstable souls or unsteadfast souls to follow them.
Right.
And then there's an interesting link with Balaam that he refers to later, because Numbers 31, through the counsel of Balaam, the children of God were ensnared by committing whoredom with the Midianitish women, through the counsel of Balaam.
The end of that verse would make it seem like the animal was much again.
Yeah. Right. And how they have exercised with covetous practices cursed children.
That word exercise is the word that we are commonly given to use. From which we get gymnastics.
Oh, right.
That. They were gymnasts in covenant.
Oh, right.
They were well practiced.
Right, and it's interesting that right in this chapter, here we have the heart, and because the heart is wrong, the eyes are wrong, and the feet are wrong, following the way of Balaam.
Yeah.
Proverbs 4, verse 23, keep thine heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life.
This is characteristic of this epistle, isn't it now? We haven't followed commonly devised fables. Now, it's coming out that they have followed the way of Balaam, the son of Beor, who loved the hire of unrighteousness.
So that they have followed the way of Balaam. They haven't followed Balaam, but they followed Balaam's way. And then many followed their way.
Yes.
Yes. I just adding the same use of the word. But there's two different classes of people that are in view in these two uses of the word, what I'm describing that. Excuse me, Fred.
I was just thinking when you said that, Dave, the thought passed in my mind, this is about Jeroboam, and long after he was dead and gone, still that expression, who made Israel sin, and that this would be supported by your comments. It's a never-ending chain, so to speak, as though my lightness will give somebody else's liberty, and you never know when it's going to end, or where it's going to end, either.
Well, certainly,
That's a good possibility. Right. No, right. He just refers to Balaam. Right, there's an emphasis here on that.
Bill, I don't know that everyone has been able to hear what you're saying.
You sit right there.
Your question is why Cain and Korah are left out of Peter, whereas they're included with Balaam and Jude. And your suggestion is, it's in keeping with the fact that covetousness runs down through 2 Peter, and covetousness was really the heartbeat of Balaam.
I thought that the point was this, that in Judeville, you have a more doctrinal issue in those three. And that is set in contrast to the faith that once and for all was delivered to the saints in Jude.
Mm-hmm.
Here I thought it was principally commercialism in gift and in ecclesiasticism, which I think is permeating this whole session. Let us not forget that all this is under the guise of religion. In fact, our brother David suggested Christianity.
Christendom.
That's the word. Isn't that your mind here? And here is the way of Balaam, is to make as much as you can out of your calling.
Right. Mr. Bentley, now check me on this too. You have suggested that doctrine seems to be primarily the emphasis in Jews. And of course, the doctrine results in wrong living.
Right.
But Peter is taking up primarily ungodliness, unrighteousness.
Yeah.
And he's exposing not so much what these men are teaching as the way they live.
And the effect of their teaching.
Yeah.
Right.
And of those three men from Jude, you wouldn't really say that Cain lived an openly ungodly life. Now, he lived apart from God, but not in the sense that these men are living. Nor even Korah. They're not examples of ungodliness of life. They're examples of insubmission and so on. But Balaam certainly is ungodliness that he introduced into Israel.
I like that you mentioned there. In Jude, he's taking up these threes and giving you the full teaching and the full king. You got a false religion. Okay? So if you have a false religion, you have Balaam. You have a false prophet. So you hire your own prophet. You prophesy what you want. And then if you have a false prophet, then you also got a false priesthood. And that's what you got out there in its full order. Mm-hmm. False religion that denies the Lord that bought them and no ownership, with a false prophet that preaches whatever they like to hear, having itching ears, and then you've got the false priesthood which is ordained of men for men, and again I use Archie Stewart's words because I know none better, empty hands on empty heads. Well, that's Jude. Here, Peter seems to come with the same sword, but the sword of the Spirit, not the job. He's chopping these men every way you know how, it seems. And as you read this, you almost flame up with Peter to say, beasts, he say, natural instinct, and natural instinct, they're brute beasts to be taken and captured. Their eyes are full of an adulteress. And he just keeps on hammering and hammering. If we don't recognize these men by the time Peter's got those, it's not Peter's fault or the brethren here. It's just too bad.
It would be useful, I think, just to list all the sakes, for the sake of the others in the audience. Revelation, the doctrine of Balaam, Jude, the error of Balaam, and 2 Peter, the way of Balaam, of the history, is the counsel of Balaam.
Numbers 31, verse 16.
The counsel.
Right. Expand that now, brother. Don't stop there.
Well, I would rather others would do that, David, really. I mean, if I give you all my week preaching sermons, there would be none left.
You'll have time to get some more before you're back.
You're right.
Repeat it again, anyway.
Well, I thought the doctrine of Balaam is in keeping with the message to the churches. And this word error that Jude is using is in very sharp contrast to the faith that was once and for all delivered to the saints. And the word way here, the road, or the path that people tread, in connection with this figurative word that has come right through the epistle, following. Striking a path, we have not followed cunningly devised tables. So here it's the way of Balaam. And so these words seem to suit the message of each book. Very significant in that connection.
Now, without preaching your sermon, here, the way of Balaam, distinctly what?
The path that Balaam would lead people to follow.
Right.
Away from divine truth.
And for hire as well.
And for hire, and ultimately moral corruption.
Yeah.
As our brother brought in the thought, he wished to corrupt the people of God, not through the daughters, but through the sons.
So then his way would bring you to his doctrine of corruption.
Correct.
All right.
That it should be his counsel to begin with.
Yeah.
But remember, what he failed to do by cursing, he achieved by corruption.
Is Balaam the original false prophet of our Bible?
The first? The first, yes. Although, mind you, there is a peculiar situation with Balaam, which I had in my mind in verse 21. I was wondering why that in chapter 1, why the Revised dropped the word holy to bring Balaam in.
Verse 21 of this chapter.
Verse 1.
Of course.
That's a deep point, but don't let us be disturbed by it. But nevertheless, Balaam speak by God, as he was moved upon by the Spirit of God. So the passage would really be descriptive of him in that unique and peculiar occasion when he gave four mighty prophecies concerning the coming Christ.
That's the very definition of false prophets at the beginning of the chapter.
That's right.
That mingled with the truth is their error, brought on the wrong side. Balaam spoke things that were right.
That's right.
Introduced his own.
I believe that's why he's in the chapter. That's why he's identifiable in the chapter to such a degree. But there is a principle in which he spake by God, and that God was pleased to use him. But it's not his speaking here that's interesting, as the ass.
Right.
Mm.
The dumbness of the ass and the madness of the prophet are contrasted.
That's it. That's it.
And the word he uses for speaking is a word that could refer to the neighing of a horse, or the barking of a dog, or thunder. But then that shows how fitting it is, because he defines it by saying, with man's voice.
Not right.
Where's that word used again in the chapter, right?
Which word?
Speaking.
The same word?
Same word.
I'm not aware of that. Oh, verse 18.
I just wondered if anybody, I didn't note that down, but I'm quite sure of that, but that's the same word, rather ironic. The dumb ass spoke to rebuke Balaam, and these men are speaking the same word as you, for their speaking.
Hey, that's right. 15 and verse 18.
Right.
Correct.
Verse 17, he has very descriptive metaphors to show the emptiness of these false teachers. Wells without water, clouds that are carried with a tempest, and people that live in a place that's dry, like the southwest of the United States, and water is very crucial. Why they come to what they expect to be a well, and there's no water there. Or clouds that they hope will bring water, and they go by. And so this shows the unsatisfactory nature of these false teachers. They don't have any true satisfaction for the people of God, or for themselves either.
They certainly wouldn't give you a refreshment.
No, right.
That would be just like imitation and unreal. That's what Satan is busy at today, giving you a counterfeit. Which is just that unreal.
Right.
If you went to them, as you would go to a well, you would get nothing. And if they came to you, like when you see a cloud coming, you could expect nothing. So either way, you've got nothing. You're going to them and they come to you, so you have to keep away.
Right. Tempest is the same word there that Peter was familiar with, the storms that came up in the lake.
Mm-hmm.
From Peter's own background, a great storm. And this great storm is carrying these mists along.
And then it says, to whom the mist of darkness is reserved forever, or the blackness of darkness, that would indicate that the punishment fits the crime. Why, they're causing darkness, and they're going to have reserved for them the blackness of darkness.
Can you get the converse out of this, what we're looking at here? A man that's living unrighteously does not refresh God's people. The only way we can be a refreshment to God's people will flow from a spiritual, a godly life.
Right.
The vows of saints are refreshed by thee.
Right.
Isn't verse 19 very descriptive that they promise liberty while themselves are the servants of corruption? That is,
right.
If people could only see the background, the life that these people are living, it is debauchery at its very worst.
Right. While they sought for freedom of self-expression, they became slaves of self.
He's saying again they're going to perish in their own corruption.
That's the same problem. In Galatians 5, the Judaizers were doing the same thing doctrinally. Would you think here it is moral? A moral permissiveness, a liberty.
What are you referring to?
A license.
What are you referring to?
Galatians, the Judaizers.
Oh, yeah.
Promising liberty, and all the time it was bondage.
Oh, yeah, right.
Here they're promising liberty, but all the time it is debauchery. Debauchery.
Just like the Lord said, John 8, verse 34, he that committeth sin is a servant of sin.
That's right.
This would fit into what is commonly spoken of today, although many of the Lord's people probably are not yet familiar with the term, and that is the term of humanism. Sometimes we mistake it for humanitarianism. There's a vast difference between the two. But the religion of humanism is sweeping the country. It's permeated our educational systems. And it's the idea that whatever man wants to do and whatever he is doing, because he is doing it, it must be right. And there's no restraint to be imposed upon man's desires or man's wishes. And it is becoming really an accepted as religion.
Liberty is to have no restraints. And that's not true. That's their philosophy. And that's bondage.
And that's why they're despising government, because government holds things in check.
Really, the last part of verse 18 shows the heartlessness of these false teachers, because it's, if I read the English Revised, those who are just escaping from them that live in error. In other words, these are just new converts. And so these men are heartless, and they're trying to ensnare them. Reminding us of the Lord's words in Matthew 18, verse 6, whosoever shall offend one of these little ones which believe in me, it were better for him than a millstone were hanged about his neck and drowned in the depth of the sea. Now, verses 20 to 22, the hopelessness and the judgment would seem to be not in keeping if this was just referring to the ones that were ensnared by the false teachers. I believe that this is really better taken as the false teachers themselves.
I think it is, because I was going to say the difference is really seen in the illustrations and in the word that the apostle uses in the illustration. First of all, the sow, the dog, rather, and the sow. It says the dog is turned through his own vomit again, and the sow that was washed through her wallowing in the mire. So now the one word turn does for both. Now, the word that the apostle uses in 1 Peter 2 is the same word. We are returned unto the shepherd and bishop of your souls. Now that word there, as I'm sure you've heard many, many a time, is in the passive. We are returning to Christ, we are turned to Christ because of a power greater than ourselves, a power outside of ourselves altogether, and we are turned to him because of what he is, the shepherd and bishop of our souls. Like what we heard last week, turn us again, O God of hosts, and we shall be turned. So there it is in the passive. The action of Christ upon us turns us away from everything to himself. But the word turned here is in the passive, in the active, rather, showing that the action is from within. It's instinctive. And these people never had divine life. They never had any recourse to Christ at all. They were simply dog-like, sow-like, following natural instinct and natural inclination. They appeared to be clean, but they just returned to a greater indulgence in evil of themselves.
They become worse.
Become worse.
It almost links with what we have in Matthew. The man, his evil spirit leaves, is garnished and swept in a sense, and then the spirits come back and he becomes so many times worse. That dog returns to its own vomit. They seem to throw everything out and revel right, and then revel right into it again.
That's right.
Right. It's not almost like to it, Frank. It is like Peter's the latter end is worse with them in the beginning.
Yes.
The exact words that are used here are the words that the Lord used.
Right.
That's
right.
In verse 20.
Right, sir. And it would be worth noticing, because we have been emphasizing throughout and will, the value of the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. It is that knowledge that has produced growth in the believer, and unto which the believer grows. But now here are people who have supposedly, I think we'd have to put that word in there, wouldn't we? They pretend to have this knowledge. And they claim that through that knowledge they'll escape the pollution of the world. But they go back to it.
I'm just using that as an example. The other links, this is just because someone initially shows a flash of something or a development, in time will test it. And if he comes to it, if there's any real Christian development, like there is in chapter 1, that development of those virtues. But in this case, whatever they profess to get in, afterward the real character comes out.
In time of temptation, they fall away, they apostatize.
Could you say that it was because of hearing of the Lord Jesus that they left these pollutions of the world, but it was only external?
Absolutely. They claim to have knowledge. I suppose these men are the men that develop later on to become known as Gnostics,
yeah.
Men who have knowledge. They claim the knowledge, but the knowledge does not affect them anything. We were contrasting that this morning between the outward and the inward, life and godliness, and so on. Partaking of the divine nature, having escaped the customers in the world through lust, inward and outward. These have the outward, and they claim to have the inward, but they don't.
Right. Then in verse 20, entangled, again entangled therein, that's another fishing word that Peter uses.
And it implies a gradual process.
Right. So it's not the act of a moment.
No.
Right.
It's developed.
It's now one of the next verses. More severe judgment based on life now.
Right.
The only other time you have that word entangled used is Paul uses it in Timothy about a soldier not entangling himself with the affairs of the
world. Right, in 2 Timothy 2, verse 4.
Right. Right. So the progressive idea and the snaring of the fish in the net, our attitude toward the world is to avoid the net.
And it's interesting that vomit, wallowing, maya, all those three words are only here, right in the same verse. And it reminds us of the Lord's words in Matthew 7, verse 6, the last verse does, when he says, give not that which is holy to the dogs, and cast not your pearls before swine. And I'd like to link that with the first verse, the hypocrite's crutch, judge not that you be not judged. Well, if you have no way of knowing who the dogs are, the swine are, you can't carry that out. And then by their fruits you shall know them. These were unsaved, they were never changed. So, the dog returns to its vomit, and the sow never was changed, so returns to its wallowing in the mire. It was only temporary external cleansing.
It feels like they have
instincts
for the beach.
Right.
And I think Peter is using language that Gentiles would know.
Right, right.
You use that word entanglement just a few minutes ago, David. Will that link us back to that? If you see him being entangled with the affairs of Sodom and Gomorrah, little did he realize that he was going as far as he did go when he started up. That he just looked like a snare or a web that just pulled around him before he got entangled and he couldn't break himself loose. Isn't that the thought there?
You have the progression in Genesis. He saw it, and he pitched his tent for it, and he was in it, and he was in the gate.
The Jews were also having their plans.
Right. And linking up with what Brother Bentley said earlier, a merely reformed person often returns to his sin, but a saved person who backslides returns to the shepherd and bishop of our souls, 1 Peter 2, verse 25.
God says, I'm sick of this. You get rid of it. And you look back to it. And that's the picture of fear. There was a sickness that they were happy to be rid of, claimed to be.
Hmm.
Falling, returned to it.
Taken from Proverbs 26, verse 11. Well, I appreciate very much the help of our brethren. Thanks.